Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to yet another exciting episode of the Vinnie Eastwood Show, broadcasting from New Zealand, the now second least corrupt country in the world, and articles just came out saying that actually bribery and corruption's a huge problem here. Guess who's reporting that? Activists? No. The major media and journalists? No. It's actually Deloitte's. Some of the most corrupt frickin' pinstripe mafia in the country. So they'd know. My very special guest, however, today is coming at us from across the ditch. And I think that this is going to be a very interesting show indeed. And I mean interesting in a good way. You know, when you show a piece of artwork to somebody else and they say, well, that's really interesting. And they don't, that's not a positive comment. I think it's going to be positive today. We have Marianne Mackay here. Marianne, welcome to the program. Glad to have you with us. Could you please explain to us a little bit about who you are and what it is you do?
I come from an area around Perth, which is known as Whadjuk country. We come from the land of the Dirbal Yerrigan, which is the land of the freshwater turtle. And I am a Yorgabilia, which is a woman of the water, a woman of the river, creator of life. So, we right 3 hours south, north and east, you know, that's all our country. And we grew up with water holes, we grew up with the river and we grew up with the beach. So it was awesome having those, you know, three different parts of water that we can enjoy as Aboriginal people, but also people in a beautiful country that we live in.
And what exactly is happening to the Aboriginal people now? I hear there's some sort of like, I don't know, broad brush evictions of native communities going on.
Yeah, well, basically what happened was last year our Prime Minister, Tony Abbott, who I have to say is the most unintelligent PM I've ever come across, basically he turned around and said that they're not going to fund Aboriginal communities, you know, remote and regional communities in WA anymore. So Colin Barnett, our WA Premier, turned around and said, well, we're just going to close them then, like sooking around for money, you know. So in the, you know, in since all of this has happened, Tony Abbott has come out and said, you know, taxpayers can't fund lifestyle choices. Now, lifestyle choice to me is someone, you know, is something that someone chooses to live. You know, it's like going to the gym, like living near the beach, like, you know, them kind of things. You know, people that live on remote and regional communities, these are traditional people living on country, and these are the original custodians of the lands that have cared for those lands since time immemorial. So that was a really offensive and insultive statement that came from the Prime Minister, and Australia just unified in a way that I haven't seen them before.
What's the background to all this? Because I understand that the media have virtually blacked this out to a large degree. They're only covering the negative side of things, the government side of things. I wondered entirely what's the Aboriginals side of the story that isn't being told.
Well, basically, this is what the Australian state and territory and federal governments do. They block out what's really going on in Australia because they want to keep that good international reputation. I mean, they're trying to get their seat back on the UN Security Council. So what is really frustrating is that, you know, the media is controlled by those with money, and those with money want power. And to further that power, they need the land, you know, in order to develop or do whatever they want to do with it. So our people, because our people come from the land, we want to care for the land, we have that spiritual connection that the non-Aboriginal person just can't understand, you know, in government, because they see it as a monetary value, whereas we see it as a spiritual connection, like Yuzmob, you know, the land is our mother and that's where everything comes from.
Well, I found that the difficulty with dealing with politicians is that they won't understand something unless it's from their perspective. So if you're not all about the money and taking things from people who can't defend themselves, then they just don't understand you.
No, well, that's right. And because there is no spiritual connection, you know, like the non-Indigenous peoples are disconnected from the land. And as Aboriginal people, I just can't understand how they can be so disconnected from what creates us. You know what I mean? Like, they wouldn't go into a church and put out the candles that are in that temple, you know what I mean? So I don't understand how, like yesterday, they can come out and put out a smoking ceremonial fire when we're conducting business. You know, they really have no respect for Aboriginal culture in Australia, and it's used as a token to look good on an international level and for, you know, visitors who come to the country. They will heritage list, you know, 200-year-old buildings, yet Aboriginal rock art, which is over 40,000 years old, doesn't get the same respect that the pyramids in Egypt would, for an example, you know. And these are rock art that, you know, they're the oldest things that are on the world that have been found besides dinosaur bones and things like that. And it's a real shame that our culture and everything that is a part of it is not embraced the way that it should be.
You know, this reminds me of how the Spanish treated a shaman in South America. Everybody who was of a different culture that was, you know, kind of like nestled into the land or anything, basically got killed to a large degree, or wiped out by hook or by crook or some way, and are still relatively well suppressed today. It's given rise to the belief that there's a spiritual oppression going on. And when you're telling me about what they're doing to Aboriginals today, a part of me is unsurprised at all, considering the long history of suppression of Aboriginals and the long fettered reputation for Australia as a fairly racist country.
Yeah, and, you know, like, Australia is so openly racist because they get away with it, you know, because we haven't been able to get our message out on an international level like we have with the forced closures of communities, you know. And what people can actually have a look at is there's a paper called Up Grabs.
Sorry, hold on, Marianne. Hold on, Marianne. A paper called what? Marianne, are you there? You might be on mute again. Oh, she's just dropped out. Oh, that's really unfortunate. AFR, if you can see if you can get her back up there, that'd be really lovely. Now, I've been thinking about this actually quite a bit lately, about the suppression of Indigenous cultures all around the world, and it doesn't matter. I mean, if you're invaded by some kind of empire, they will strive to wipe out the culture that preceded them. And this is an effort.
Yeah, I'm here.
Go ahead, Marianne.
Are you there, Vinny?
Go ahead.
Yeah, sorry, I got cut off. You know, things like that happen on our phones all the time. yeah, so did you manage to hear what I just said about the Up for Grabs publication?
Up for Grabs publication. Okay, yeah, I got it.
Yep. So that came from, yeah, the Weekend Australian magazine, July 16 and 17, 2011. So the Dutch had mapped the top half of Australia and the bottom bit from around Geraldton, maybe around to Adelaide, and then a bit of Tassie. So, you know, what has happened here is that the British have just come along, and basically these mob have respected our people, you know, and traded with our people, whereas the British came along and just saw that we were a vulnerable, easy mob, peaceful people, and they could just come in and just take the land. You know, and to be able to do that, Queen Victoria in the Pacific Islanders Protection Act actually said that we were still a sovereign nation and they had no sovereignty over us. So they were to fund our people, you know, to survive while the British colonies were expanding. And they didn't do this. Instead, they just removed our people, you know, removed our women, had babies with them, took the babies away, you know, murdered and massacred our people, you know, and sexually assaulted our women. The same story right around the world with Indigenous nations, you know. And it's just really sad that we can live in such a first world country and our people can suffer from third world conditions, you know, which World Vision fight for on a daily basis.
You're not just fighting third world conditions, because third world conditions exist around the world. You're fighting like 19th century conditions. The kind of oppression of people that you haven't seen in 200 years or whatever is still going full tilt. That's what it sounds like to me.
Yeah, well, that's right. And I was yarning with a lady yesterday, and we were talking about the fact that, you know, things that we're going through now, people people have been through all of this and they have survived and they've risen up and they've been able to come forward within their own nations, you know, and fight for that recognition. And that's one thing that the government are putting out over here is a recognition campaign for us to be recognised in their constitution. And they're promoting it as a positive thing, and it's not. We don't want recognition in that constitution because it's an illegal and invalid document, and we want a treaty from sovereign nation to sovereign nation, you know. And one that's, you know, negotiated on our terms, not dictated by government.
One thing I see in a lot of other countries is that some of the natives, and particularly the half-breeds, they kind of get recruited by the ruling elite to be sort of custodians slash rulers, and they wind up at the heads of all these trusts and what have you, merely facilitating the government's agenda and getting paid handsomely for it while their people starve. Is that happening in Australia as well as the rest of the world? Or?
Oh, yeah, for sure. We call them 9-to-5 blacks. All we call them coconuts, you know. Yeah, that's our main word is coconuts. You know, and, yeah, they're 9-to-5 blacks, all we call them, you know, like I don't really want to say it in case it offends anyone, but, you know, like house niggers, you know, but I don't mean that in a degrading way. I just mean, you know, that's how we all talk. And so I don't want that term to cause offence to anyone, but they're just things that we call these mob. And the main term is coconuts because they're brown on the outside and white on the inside, and they have sold their souls to the devil, we say, because our culture cannot be bought because it doesn't belong to us. It belongs to the future generations. And we only have a custodianship to hold that and keep that until it's our turn to pass it down to the next one in line. You know, so we're not for sale, so we can't be bought, whereas those kinds of people can. And it's really sad that they can disconnect themselves so much from culture and be bought with the white man's money that comes from the blood and sweat of our people and their deaths, you know. And it's really an insult and an offence. And I think that people like that really need to, you know, be healed and find that path back towards, you know, the spirit that they're supposed to really be.
It's a betrayal, ultimately, and I don't think there's a whole lot of crimes that I hold in lower esteem than the betrayal of one's own people.
Well, that's right, you know, and we have, you know, deaths in custody is a huge issue in the country as well. You know, we have a lot of our people dying in custody for no reason, you know, lack of primary health care, simple things like that. You know, we have our children being removed at an alarming rate, worse than ever, you know, and being because they want to assimilate our kids and away from culture. You know, we have our people being dispossessed of their lands time and time again, and it's really, really wrong.
How much are we talking about here? I mean, in terms of the white man's reasoning, how much money, how many hectares of land are we talking about? How long have these communities been around?
These communities have been around since like the beginning of time, you know what I mean? These are homeland communities, and they take up the whole, you take out the southwest of WA, which is Noongar country, and all these communities are in the rest of WA, rich in resources, mining everything. Yeah, rich in resources, mining everything. And that's what they want. It's a land grab for minerals and resources that the government can just make as much money as they can off of.
Well, you've kind of gone a bit muffled there, Marianne. Have you picked up the bubs, have you?
Yeah, I've just got a three-year-old that's demanding that she have her towel because she'd like to get out of the shower.
Oh, that's very nice. Well, you go attend to that because I just want to kind of pontificate upon the parallels between the Avatar movie and exactly what's going on in here, isn't it? Oh, you people are under this big tree. Oh, you're just a bunch of savages or whatever. We'll just blow the hell out of it because it's sitting on top of the resources that we want that we don't own already. You know, the use of force.
That's right. Well, that's right, eh? And Avatar, as soon as we've seen that movie the very first time, that's us. And that is every Indigenous country around the world as well. You know, so I actually think that was a political message. Whoever, the people who wrote that movie and did that, like, they're awesome because that is a parallel and that's what's going on with all Indigenous nations. But I've got to go and do my mum thing.
Conveniently, we have a break coming. So if you want to just mute your mic out, we've got a break coming for about 4 or 5 minutes, and then you can get your home business done and then come straight back on air. How's that? We'll be right back, ladies and gentlemen. Don't you go anywhere. You listen to The Vinnie Eastwood Show. It's a listener-supported broadcast. Go to thevinnieeastwoodshow.com and donate today. And welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to The Vinnie Eastwood Show, the show that's all about jamming. And I hope you like peanut butter too. And my very special guest is Marianne Mackay. Marianne, welcome back. Are you still there?
Yeah, I'm still here.
Oh, that's beautiful. Great, glad to hear your voice still. So, we were talking about Avatar. You had a few comments about that. But before you do, somebody asked me, I think about 2 years ago, Vinny, how expensive is farmland in New Zealand? And I said, well, let me put it like this. The only people who can buy it are Chinese conglomerates and James Cameron. That's how expensive it is. All right, but anyway.
Yeah, that's Korea, yeah.
So if you want to talk about Avatar for just for a moment in terms of an allegory for how indigenous races are treated, it's pretty straightforward. In fact, we were talking on the show yesterday about, I think it was Captain America, the Winter Soldier, and the great allegory there against the military-industrial complex and the surveillance state. And there's a great hope now that filmmakers, artists, and all people, creative or not, will somehow be able to get the message out about what's really happening in the world, whether it has to be through fiction or through reality, it matters not, as long as it gets out.
Yeah, well, that's right. And so with Avatar, you see how they have the scientists, you know, the smart people, and then they, you know, put them into an Avatar body to learn, you know, everything so that they can, you know, do their research properly and learn how they can manipulate, you know, like the mob to go in there and steal all that blue, what is it, plutonium or whatever it's called?
It was called unobtainium, which is apparently not that difficult to obtain.
Yeah. Well, that's right. And you look at all of those messages that are in the movie. And so what you've got here is, you know, an alien race coming in, trying to get to know the original custodians of the land in order to benefit their own self, you know. So you've got the mob coming in. They don't want to be a part of it. They don't want to negotiate. They don't want to move. You know, that's their spiritual connection. That's their land, their livelihood, you know. That's their mother. And so then you've got the big bulldozers and everything, and it's like, well, if they're not going to move, we'll just move them ourselves. So then they go to war. And if you look, that's what's happened right around the world with all the indigenous nations, you know. And it's, you know, in this movie, it's really inspiring because, you know, the Avatar mob win, you know, the Na'vi win, not the you know, government mob. So in the end, they managed to save their lands, but they've had to go through a whole lot of suffering and actually stand up and fight for it, and their people actually died for it, you know, and it's the same here, you know, just persecution and manipulation.
I wanted to know if, like Māori, who were actually the original inventors of trench warfare, which was later on adopted by Western powers in the Great War, was there much of a an armed resistance to British rule by Aboriginals at any point?
Oh, our people stood up and fought, but you've got spears against guns and horses, you know what I mean? And our mob had spears and legs. And that was about it, you know, and the boomerangs and things like that. So it was really our people did stand up and they tried to fight back, you know, but the Westerns, you know, all them invaders like Captain James Stirling and that, which was our invader on the West Coast, they just basically massacred and murdered anyone who stood in their way because they had the firepower, they had the armoury, they had the people and the money behind them. You know, which is just like modern day. They have the money, they have the people, they have the army. You know, they took the army into the Northern Territory to go and invade those communities, you know, back in 2007. And they call it the Northern Territory Emergency Response, but it's the intervention. And they went in there on false reports. The government blatantly lied. And now you've got people up there having 50% of their income quarantined onto these basics cards, which you can only buy food and things like that at certain shops. So you've got people in remote areas being ripped off and paying things like $7 for one capsicum that we'd pay $1.50 for or something here. you know, and it's really hard because they're taking the children, you know, on false allegations, and the government can do it because they get away with it. And the army came in to Mutitjulu, which is near Uluru. It's the community there. And, you know, just terrified the elders and the people. And people can see a bit of that on Utopia, which is by John Pilger. It was a documentary made a few years ago. And we also spoke about Rottnest Island, which is an island in WA where they took all of our mob and created a prison over there. And it's about 45 minutes by ferry, you know, from Perth or Fremantle. And, you know, they have tourist lodges and things like that where the roundhouse jail was, where there were executions, and they've got people walking all over the burial grounds that don't have protection or recognition, you know, and that's Aboriginal people from right across WA.
And to make it into like a personal thing, it's like somebody walking in your house and just pretending like it's theirs and kicking you out.
Well, that's right. And last year or the year before, I forget because the years go by so fast, we actually had enough, you know, and we actually stalked out our Premier's house. And we went to his home and we staged a vigil there all day until the Premier would take these documents off us because Parliament House lied and said they never got them. So when we gave Parliament House the receipt number for our documents, all of a sudden they could pull them up. But if we didn't have that receipt number, they wouldn't have pulled them up, you know. So because they lied to us, we went straight to the Premier's home. We were there all day. The police came. They tried to negotiate. And we just told them, we're not going to move until your Premier bees a man and takes these documents off us. You know, we are sovereign people and we don't want to be under their jurisdiction. They need the treaty and they need to do the right thing, you know, and they're just not. And there was a media backlash and, as usual, they missed the issue of the whole point and they just spoke about us being at the Premier's home and causing fear to his wife. And it's like, well, Mr. Barnett's, you know, the Premier Barnett's wife wasn't scared. She came out swearing at us, telling us to, you know, F off, you know. And it's like they manipulate the public. And we said to them, you're talking about us coming to Colin Barnett's home. Well, now he knows how we feel, you know. Now he knows how we feel, how he comes into our lands and our countries and dictates to us and imposes their genocidal policies with no protection for our people and no avenue to appeal for our rights, you know.
It sounds like his wife's very prepared to act in a stately manner.
Oh, yeah. Might have invited us in for a cup of tea and a scone, but, you know, we got...
I mean, even the CEO of Dutch Royal Shell invited the protesters for tea and coffee and biscuits on his lawn when they descended upon his house, and he talked to them for hours upon hours. Now, that's an unelected representative dealing with protesters against a corporation that he just happens to be CEO of at his own home. And then you have a statesman and his wife acting like this when they're supposed to actually have some kind of responsibility?
Well, that's right. That's right. And Colin Barnett actually said to us, you know, you made a mistake coming to my home. And it's like, you know, is that a direct threat, Mr. Premier? You know, and he wouldn't answer us. And when he took the documents, all the media had to stay down the stairs. No one was allowed to follow me and my sister there, Vanessa Colwong. No one was allowed to follow us up to the steps when we gave him the documents. And his face was so red. And he is Colin Barnett. We have documentation and photos of his grandmother with Aboriginal grandmothers because they were sisters. And his grandmother was at Wandering Mission, which is an Aboriginal mission in the southwest of WA. And he denies his own Noongar heritage, yet he stands there and says that he has respect for culture and he just wants to help our people. You know, like he's very patronising, and we believe that he's a very evil man and he just wants to wipe out Aboriginal culture in the best interests of money and power and mining and big business. You know, it's just disgusting.
Well, everybody, like, who's a good, decent, moral person says this to me all the time, but I just don't understand. Why would they do that? Why would they do that? And my answer is, you're not a criminal sociopath. If you were, it would make total sense to you.
Well, it's because they can, you know. It's because they can. They get away with it, and so they just keep doing it and keep doing it and keep doing it. And it's like down at the island, at Harrison Island, which we call Muttagarup, where the Noongar 10 Embassy is. And we created a refugee camp there for people who are going to be displaced from the closures of communities. And basically they come there and they raid all the time. They take our tents. They take everything that's there. And yet under their law, their Aboriginal Heritage Act of WA, we have the right to camp there and we have the right to hunt and gather materials and engage in culture because that's a registered site under their law. Even though we don't need their recognition, we know we can go there anyway. But they put place a bylaw, which is actually illegal and created under a state statute, above a state statute and a federal law. You know, and they come in and they raid and steal our stuff all the time. And because we can't get a proper lawyer, because no one in WA will stand up for us, well, we can't even sue them and take them to court because they're doing the wrong thing, you know, and prove that. And so that's what we really need is lawyers, you know, to be able to fight for us because we have the evidence there.
I don't think
we just don't know how to work through those processes.
You don't need a lawyer that's going to fight for you. You want a lawyer who's willing to risk everything that he has, including his home, his career, and his honour to defend you because he's going to face whatever the same kind of threats and tyrannical measures and subversion that your people have faced. And I think that's part of the reason why the government has cracked down so massively on Indigenous communities who try to engage in the legal system to a large degree globally is because A1, it'll work, and B2, unless you make sure that all the people who can make it work are too scared, you know, then you're in trouble.
Well, that's right, you know, and that is right. You know, we have to have, you know, like strong lawyers that are willing to give it everything that they've got and sacrifice if that's what it comes down to. And that's why it is so hard to engage one, you know, because, you know, you've got people out there that want to help and want to support, but at the end of the day, if their personal lives, you know, livelihoods are put at stake, well, they're not going to do that, you know, when it comes to life in general, you know what I mean? I don't want to make it sound like people are selfish, but it's just that, you know, you have to, you know, think of your family and your obligations to your family before you can think about the extended and wider community and the impacts, you know, like you're saying. And that's why we would really love it if there was someone out there, you know, that was willing to give it their all and stand up and support us. And Even if you know, people don't want to engage in that court process, even if they were willing to give us advice on how we can represent ourselves and do that for ourselves, you know what I mean, and engage in that way, and then that way they're not putting themselves out there as such if they were part of a court case.
Well, each of these lawyers must have to ask themselves that there is a difference between paying lip service and pushing the envelope. You've got to actually be on the field of battle, standing shoulder to shoulder with the people that you're trying to protect if you ever hope to stand in the way of those who are trying to hurt them, all right? I think this is the basic rule of history. It's 1 to 5% max of the population who stand up, put themselves on the line, and they change history. Everybody else is along for the frickin' ride.
Well, that's right. That's right. And that's what we get really frustrated with, you know, because we're constantly on the ground in the front line, you know, and we're constantly, you know, we're the ones that are always going through the police raids, you know, the harassment by police, the racial attacks, you know, on the Noongar 10 Embassy and things like that. And then we're constantly vilified in the media, which then gives the public a perception that we're these, you know, violent, aggressive mobs, you know, that are just trying to cause trouble with the police and the government, when actually we're a peaceful people that are hurt and angry and we're just trying to stand up for our rights and get recognised, you know. And that is often the problem. The people on the front line are the ones who are put down and stuff like that. And then when everything goes the way that the mission was supposed to, then that's when, you know, you've got all these coconuts standing up wanting to reap in the benefits of our hard work and suffering, you know.
Well, they haven't earned it, and this is the problem that I really have. And I don't know, just in general, I'm a very angry person, but the thing that makes me most angry is seeing the powerful prey on the vulnerable and have no real ability to defend themselves. It just seems cruel, psychopathic, and inhuman to me. And part of the concordance of frustration that I feel with that is that I know that those kind of people who do that kind of thing have popular support of the racist public. You know? I mean, I'm not saying that white people are all bad or anything. I'm just saying that sometimes people are racist for no good freaking reason, and they support racist policies which hurt large swathes of people who have done nothing wrong and haven't even planned on doing anything wrong at all.
Well, that's right, and I agree with you too, you know, and it's really frustrating because we're out there trying to do the right thing, and we can't understand how the government can put money and land and power above proper, you know, human values and morals that their parents should have instilled in them, you know, or probably did instill in them, but they just grew out of it as they grew older and learned what money can do, you know. And it's really frustrating because we're here just trying to do the right thing.
Marianne, I'm sorry, we're coming to break. We'll be right back, ladies and gentlemen. And welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the final segment of the first hour here with Marianne Mackay. Now, is there an organization or some kind of website that you're running? But before we get into that and the plugging, I would like you to continue, because we kind of got cut off by the break there. You were talking about your frustration with the strong picking on the weak of the community and that kind of thing.
Basically just saying that, you know, it's really hard with, you know, that divide and conquer method, you know, and I think right around the world it was Willie Lynch's divide and conquer method that, you know, assisted the Western system with, you know, Indigenous peoples and persecution and dispossession and things like that. And it's really hard trying to unify our people when, you know, you have the ones that have assimilated and moved over to the other side, so to speak. And, you know, we're constantly persecuted and vilified for being on the front line, yet when we succeed, they're right there, you know, receiving the first handout and reaping the benefits of work that they didn't even engage in. And like yesterday, we had a gathering in the city in Forest Chase so that we could get some petitions signed, a state petition against the closures of the communities. And we ended up getting about 100 signatures on the petition, but while we were doing that, we had a smoking ceremony because you've always got to smoke up, you know, before you engage in any kind of business, you know, and clear that energy and call up that strength, you know, from the good spirits and stuff, positive vibes. So it creates encouragement for what we have to do. Mm. Well, the police and the rangers, the ABC media were there, did a story. Then when they left, as soon as the cameras were gone, the police moved straight in with a bucket of water, distinguished our smoke, said that it's a public safety issue, smoke everywhere, rah, rah, rah. And then they turned around and I said, well, if that's the issue, and I grabbed the leaves and I picked them all up and I walked off and I tried to light them. And he said, hey, if you light that, you're going to be arrested. And I said, what for? Engaging in a cultural ritual, like this is our smoking ceremony and you've put our fire out. So they ended up saying that, you know, if I light it up, I'm going to be arrested. So my elders were like, no, you know, you're not doing it. So I ended up getting a move on notice, which is the government give you, the police in Western Australia give you a move on notice, which says that you have to move on from that area and you're not allowed to come back within 24 to 72 hours. And they create a boundary around a perimeter around the city where you're not allowed to go. And it's back in like the mission days when our people were, you know, told they can't be in a city at a certain time of night and stuff. And that was a real insult, and I wouldn't take it off the police officer. I said, no, I'm not contracting with you. You can't move on an Aboriginal person from my own country. And I just walked off, and he threw it down at my feet and said, it's served, you have to go. So in the end, I had to leave, and it was really frustrating because we were there trying to stand up for our people and the police come along. And as soon as the police come along, then the crowd gathered around everywhere, you know, whereas before that, not one single person would get up and sign our petition. And this is the city of Perth in lunch hour. So there were people everywhere. And it's things like that that happen all the time. And then we're the ones that are made out to look like the bad people because we're just causing trouble for attention.
It's freaking unbelievable. I've seen less police suppression happen at a meeting of the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws. You know, they're just like, oh, you're smoking away. Go for your life, son. But Aboriginals doing it as some kind of cultural practice. Oh, my God. Oh, my God. We're going to stamp that out, bro. It's a public safety issue.
Yeah, like a safety issue. You know, like you're talking to the oldest living culture on the world who manages fire. Like, what an insult, you know what I mean? They're always talking about you need to listen to the experts. Well, the Perth City Council and the West Australian Police never listen to the experts, you know, so they're all hypocrites who contradict everything they say, you know.
This reminds me of what my mate Gavin King, I think he lives in South Australia. He applied to be a member of the Australian Federal Police, and they came back with his IQ test, and they go, "Nah, it's too high, mate. We can't induct you into the police force. You just go out of your mind with boredom." And he's like, "Well, hold on a second. I'm really smart. I'm really intelligent. Couldn't you use people like that?" And they're like, "Nah."
that just goes to show,
you know, some things are exactly as they seem.
Well, that's right, and they can be very arrogant. And the thing with our police commissioner over here is that he is constantly vilifying our people, whereas he had really bad drug issues with his son. And instead of standing up with the community to increase funding for drug awareness and drug rehabilitation and things like that, he just totally ignored it and got everything brushed aside so that the story was kind of like closed up and forgotten about. You know, and the police presence, like you've only got to look at the James Price Point campaign, you know, dinosaur footprints and everything up there, and they still wanted to create a gas hub. And they flew like 100 police officers or more from Perth up to Broome to fight for the mining company and remove all the protesters off there. And it's like, well, you know, the police force, they're actually a private security firm for big business and government. And yeah, we see time and time again what public they protect and serve, you know?
I just love the irony of sending 100 police to Broome to sweep away the activists. Well, of course, that's right, eh?
Like, you know, you've got a couple of hundred activists and they need, you know, all these police with their tasers and guns to remove them. I mean, what's Australia coming to?
It's freaking overkill is what it is. I don't know. We've been having these arguments on Facebook recently, Marianne, and these people are like arguing about this Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement. Nobody knows what the hell's in it because it's secret, right? And one person's arguing in favour of it and one of them's arguing not in favour of it. Okay, and I think the whole point is here, it's secret, so you can't argue for favour or against what's in it if you don't know. And what's happening here in Australia seems to be very much a similar thing. People just don't know what the argument is. People don't know what the legislation is. And half the people, even though they do know, are on the side of the enemy and they don't freaking care. They haven't got an empathetic or moral bone in their body.
Well, that's right, and that's what we always say. You know, our fight is against the system, and, you know, our job is to educate those that aren't aware, you know. And so we try to explain to, you know, non-Aboriginal people that we're not against them. We're against the system, and we have to educate those that are with the system, you know, to try and let them know, you know, this is, we're just trying to do the right thing. We're not against anyone. We don't hate anyone. We just despise the system that has tried to conquer our people for the last 200 years. And we just want everything to be right and fair and equal and just as it should be. And if they're going to implement things on our people, like the basics cards and things like that, well, it should be done right across the board to every single person that lives in this country, not just for one particular group of people, you know. It just needs to be fair, and that's all we want is fair rights and recognition, you know.
Yeah. I mean, that's pretty straightforward. I mean, just a message to the Australian police is not that we hate you, it's that we just despise you. I think there's just this lack of understanding.
Yeah, well, that's right.
You know, you got to have laugh with it. I mean, just because of being enslaved by ruthless criminals doesn't mean we can't have fun with it. Otherwise, what's the point of being slaves?
Well, that's right. You know, that's what keeps us going is our black humour, you know. And
you're black.
You know, they come and camp with us, and they understand that black humour, but they can't understand how we can be in such a traumatic situation and still smile. And that's where you know with your mob, you know, the music and the dance comes in, and then you all have a good laugh and you joke, because that's the only way you can get through it. And no one wants to sit there sad crying all the time. You know, we need to laugh and lift up our spirits. And it's easy too, because it takes less muscles to smile, so you're actually doing less work for yourself, you know.
Mm. And you feel less exhausted afterwards. In fact, you actually feel a little bit more energised. Sitting around with your mates and having exactly good laughs and what have you. I mean, isn't that what we're fighting for at the end of the day? The ability to sit around without getting raided, without being surveilled, just having a good laugh and a good time and enjoying life with Mother Earth.
Well, that's right. And that's all we want, is to live. We just want to live like everyone else, but on our terms, not theirs, and with respect. You know, because we know we can't send them all home to England, because half the country, half the world lives in Australia now, you know. So we know we can't send everyone back home. Otherwise, I'd be sending half my family back to Scotland and Ireland, you know. So, and it's, you know, we know that we've got to live together, and we've got to survive on this beautiful country, you know. And everyone has the right to enjoy the beauty of Australia, but just with respect to the original custodians, and just with respect to what it is that our people actually need to keep this land sustainable for the future, because that is our job at the end of the day. And our cultural obligation is to Mother Earth, because that's where everything comes from. And if we nurture her, she'll nurture us. And that's the way that it should be.
Yeah. With people, I think it's a little bit different. It's kind of like the way to coexist in harmony is to give each other their space.
Yeah, well, that's right, you know. And, you know, if we have people that want to live on their traditional homelands, you know, and be remote and regional, well, you know, we should respect their wishes. It's their country. It's their people's country since forever. So they should be allowed to continue, you know, their cultural obligations as their people always have.
Yeah. I mean, just stop killing, abusing, stealing and destroying our culture, then we won't have any problems, son. That's pretty straightforward, I would have thought. Marianne Mackay, ladies and gentlemen, has been my very special guest talking about the Aboriginal culture in Australia. And we'll be right back after the break. And I've got a little bit of New Zealand news and some articles to read out. Thank you very much for listening. Donate at thevinnieeastwoodshow.com. Back in a moment. And welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to hour number two of the fastest 2 hours in talk radio. It's the Vinnie Eastwood Show, broadcasting from New Zealand, the fabulous, allegedly corruption-free place. But anyway, article in here from stuff.co.nz. Bribery and corruption, a growing threat in New Zealand. This is by Deloitte. How delightful. New Zealand's transparent and ethical image has been challenged by a new report suggesting bribery and corruption are a real and growing issue.
Well, I wonder how long it took them to figure that one out.
Oh my God, this country's so freaking corrupt. Basically, it's, I don't know, it's kind of like a really bad cake covered in really nice icing. As soon as you take the icing off of the cake, you're left with something that you just don't want to take a bite of. It's pretty much it. The survey carried out by professional services firm Deloitte canvassed 269 public and private organisations across New Zealand and Australia. It revealed almost a quarter had experienced domestic corruption in the last 5 years, and of those incidents, more than half occurred in the last 12 months. So not only is it really bad, and it's been bad for a while, but it's getting worse significantly in recent times. Or at least that's what it says to me. And considering the activists that I've interviewed, the people from the Mangawhai Ratepayers Association, Penny Bright, Vince Seema, Evelyn Gilbert, Ben Vidgen, and other New Zealand commentators, and people who are exposing the truth about how this country really runs, I would say that's about right. Deloitte lead forensics partner Barry Jordan said there was no excuse for complacency. He's got that one correct. Apart from the legal ramifications, which can include heavy fines or even jail time, the long-term reputational damage from corruption can have serious long-term flow-on effects on an organization's bottom line, he said. Of course, unless you manage to keep the corruption concealed, in which case your bottom line keeps getting fed rather healthily. On and on it goes. No industry was immune, with every sector experiencing at least some reported incidents. The most common types of corruption included undisclosed conflicts of interest. And I can just think about the huge amount of conflicts of interest there. Even in the Mangawhai Ratepayers Association, you have people who are appointed by the government who are tied to local contracting companies, who are then hiring those contracting companies and increasing people's rates at an initially proposed a rate increase of 1,800%, and then pocketing the rest of the money for blown out budgets. It's freaking bad, man. And not only conflicts of interest, but supplier kickbacks and personal favours. And this even extends into the political realm, where candidates in this recent by-election have indeed made promises and have said that those promises won't come through if somebody else is elected, right? So that's kind of like doing favours, making promises. Everybody thinks that's a normal electioneering thing. When you threaten to take away benefits if you don't get elected, that's no longer a normal engineering thing. That's like a threat. That's like corruption, bro. That's like bribery, which includes a whole bunch of other elements. And you can listen to the Penny Bright interview that I did a couple of days ago, I think, on the Vinnie Eastwood Show archives. If you search Penny Bright, you should come up with the most recent episode there, where she covers the exact statute in which bribery can be transposed to a politician. And it seems that these ones in the recent by-election tip off that mark as well. They were mostly uncovered through management reviews, internal controls, and tip-offs from employees. Now, of course, if we don't have whistleblower protection in this country, so if those employees had gone public and gone whistleblowing, they would have been in a bit of trouble. In larger organizations with more than 5,000 employees, dedicated hotlines for tip-offs were the most effective. It's because it's anonymous. If you anonymously inform on a group of criminals, the group of criminals doesn't know who informed on them, because they know that they're a group of criminals and that it could be anybody that they've shafted, which could be everybody that they've ever done business with. It seems that that would be the most effective method, isn't it? Being able to expose people without having to reveal yourself. I think that's why journalists are trusted a lot by informants and what have you, because they don't reveal their sources. The survey also revealed companies with overseas operations were experiencing an increase in bribery and corruption incidents outside New Zealand. And, of course, this canvassed Australia, which has an independent commission against corruption. Now, it's not perfect in Australia, but we don't even have an independent commission against corruption in New Zealand. And in Australia, the WIDE reports the most well-reported and documented corruption has been local government, contracting, and procurement. That's where the money is. That's where the bribery is. That's where the corruption is, to a large degree. Privatisation. Now, I know that this might be a little bit difficult for the people with libertarian ideology, etc., to stomach. And that's because it's not right-wing to privatise things using public money to do it. What it's doing is it's kind of turning itself into an infinity loop, where the corruption goes in, it does its little work around in the money machine, and then it spits back out the result, i.e. profit, for a bunch of private shareholders out of public money. All right, now granted, that problem wouldn't be there if there weren't the public money to play with to allow these people to, you know, think, that's quite a good pot of gold at the end of that rainbow. I think I might just murder a leprechaun. Get myself in there. There's a reason why conspiracy is against the law. Because it exists. There's actually laws that make conspiring illegal. There's definitions for it, that kind of thing. You know why there aren't laws against leprechauns? Because they're not real. That's pretty much it, isn't it? One in three had an incident in the last 5 years, and up to one in five in 2012, when a similar survey was conducted. The survey found only 31% of companies with overseas business had a comprehensive understanding of relevant laws. And, of course, ignorance is no excuse when it comes to the law, unless, of course, you've got a hell of a lot of money, in which case you can just keep your money. Oh, because he just didn't know. He must have been doing it for altruistic reasons. 40% reported not having a formal compliance program in place or not knowing if they had one, although that was an improvement from 57% in 2012. A lot of people accuse me of being unprofessional, and I admit it. But my argument is, the world's currently run by professionals. How's that working out for you? When 40% don't even know that they've got a compliance program. You know, up from 57%. It's out of control. People have this faith in the professional community that they actually know how to do their jobs. Professionals are just like any other people. They have strengths, weaknesses, stupidity, intelligence, you know. It's all up in the air. You don't know who you're dealing with. Unless you know their track record, unless you know their reputation. And I find it ironic. Deloitte's, I'm not 100% sure if they're part of the New Zealand pinstripe mafia, much like PricewaterhouseCoopers, who do a lot of the valuations for the government and major corporate banks in New Zealand here. And, my God, there's a lot of nasty stuff in those companies. I'm not sure if Deloitte can be tarred with the same brush. However, the Deloitte report said bribery laws overseas were often more rigorously enforced than New Zealand's own foreign bribery laws, and sometimes had extraterritorial reach. Jordan said there were encouraging signs pointing to an improvement from 2012, but still a way to go. Quote, corruption risk could not be a barrier to growth and new markets, but it does need to be properly understood and managed, he said. If you're going into a country that has massive risk of corruption, according to this dude, it's not a barrier to growth and new markets. Well, of course it's not. Because the people who are going to be engaging in the bribery and corruption own the marketplace. You've got to be freaking kidding me. You got sit rack and got really effed off just because the people who are supposed to know what the F they're talking about clearly don't know what the F they're talking about. And you sit here and you get angry. Unfreaking believable. Moving on to lighter news. Amazon to test delivery drones in US. Yeah, it's going to be cool, man. What do you got, like 8 blades on this little thing and a little package in the middle of it? You know, it's all done by cross beams and things like that. So it'll just fly around, come to your house, and drop off your Amazon products for speedy delivery. You sit at home, you click on something, you buy it with your credit card, and then a couple of minutes later, a freaking little robo-droid turns up at your door with your product. Now, that seems really cool in some senses of the word. Like, oh, that's great, that's convenient, that's fantastic. However, goodness knows what other kind of stuff they're going to be talking about. What about rampant drone delivery? Like the FAA is saying that these people need to like give them reports and everything. They're only just going into the testing stages of this thing, and they're only allowed to fly at about 400 feet. That's 122 meters for those of you in the metric system. Or slightly below that within daylight hours, and the pilot has to keep in visual contact with this thing the whole time. I don't know exactly how it's going to work. But I wonder if this kind of technology would be used to, I don't know, spy on people. Because it does say here that they have to send all their data and flight routes and everything back to the FAA, connected to the US government. I don't know, probably tapped in with the... I'm just assuming blatantly here. Really. I'm totally reaching. But whenever some new kind of fancy technology comes up, the first part of me, as I mentioned before, goes, oh, that's cool. And the second part of me goes, I wonder how they're going to use it to screw me. Yeah. Have I jumped the chasm here? Am I doing something silly? Or is that actually quite a reasonable response? I think it is. I really do. Speaking of unreasonable responses, election 2014, might be a little out of date, of course, secrecy jitters over agreement. I was having an argument over Facebook today about the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement. And one of the things that I tried to really make the point of is that nobody knows what's in it, apart from those who've read the leaked WikiLeaks version of it, of course. And so you can't argue in favour of something that you don't know what's in it. All right? You really can't, especially if you can't even know what's in it even after it's signed for another 4 years, after it's already been implemented. I mean, what are you going to do, bro? Really? What can you do about it once it's already there, once it can't be stopped? I don't understand this. Again, because I'm probably not a psychopath. But bottom line, because it's secret, regardless of the pros and cons, you have no clue whatsoever what pros or cons there are. It's like trying to sell a used car to someone on the proviso that they can't do any kind of service, any kind of checks or inspections. They can't even see the car or drive or test drive it before making the purchase. And then sign a contract that even after you make the purchase, you're still bound to not drive it, not test drive it, not do any checks or services or anything for 4 years afterwards. It's completely insane how anybody could think that this is something that's worth supporting. Simply because, again, they don't know what's in it. Right? And they say that anybody who opposes the TPPA is a conspiracy theorist. Right, well, bro, what you're proposing here, your version of it, that we should just sign it, and it's all done, it's all gravy? What you're proposing is a coincidence theory. The theory that people with massive wealth and power that do things in secret only ever do so for totally altruistic reasons and sound commercial judgment. I mean, I'm arguing against the secrecy primarily, because what kind of partnership excludes the partners in the decision-making process? It's freaking insane. Think about what can be signed away. It's really, really quite nasty. Onto the article. The government is negotiating an international agreement called the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement, or TPPA, that involves 11 Asian and Pacific Rim countries, including the United States. The government says that if it goes ahead, it will provide billions of dollars worth of advantage to New Zealand, but critics say negotiations have been held in secret, and what we know about the TPPA comes from leaked documents and detective work. Do you support the TPPA, and why or why not? And these are asking these questions to the political candidates. So, here we have David Curran from the Internet Party. This is the first on the list. The Internet Party will safeguard the ability of New Zealanders to democratically exercise sovereign control and make decisions without undue influence over our country. We oppose the TPPA. The TPPA is not just another free trade agreement, and in fact only 5 out of the 29 chapters actually deal with free trade issues. Leaked texts from the secret negotiations have shown the potential for the agreement to have deep negative impact for New Zealand, with protocols reaching far across our borders into such as investment, competition, regulations, environment, and labour. Those are the elements that the government's supposed to control. I mean, and you could, of course, make the argument that nobody should really be in control of that. We should have a free market. But it's not a free market if the big players in the market make up what the rules of the market are. All right, isn't that a monopoly? Oh, no. A monopoly is granted to a corporation by government. Why am I on some kind of like bent libertarian apologist rant here? I don't know. All negotiating texts and other materials, such as proposals of each government, are secret and remain so until 4 years after negotiations are finalised. It's just crazy. You listen to the Vinnie Eastwood Show, and we'll be right back after the break. Bear in mind, this is a listener-supported broadcast, and trying to raise $4,000 to pay back the lovely man who donated a rather expensive computer that I need to make my documentary. So go to thevinnieeastwoodshow.com, donate today. We'll see you after the break. And welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. Broadcasting on AmericanFreedomRadio.com 4 days a week. You can also listen live at the homepage of TheVinnieEastwoodShow.com, as well as search the archives there. There are also links to YouTube videos, versions of the broadcast as well. So I hope you enjoy that and check it out, because we don't have an advertising budget. We're not paying anybody to go out promoting. We're not doing anything. It is all word of mouth. So if you don't share this show, it just doesn't get shared. You know, it's as simple as that. And there are levels of support that I appreciate. You know, sharing a post on Facebook or emailing out a link of a particular broadcast to one of your friends or anything like that. Don't underestimate the meaning and the power of that, because you're doing something that I can't do for myself, that the network can't do for itself. You're contributing in a way that is absolutely invaluable. And I want to thank everybody who shares and helps to promote the Vinnie Eastwood Show and American Freedom Radio. You bloody good people. That's all there is to say about it. Now, in terms of the TPPA, continuing on, public discussions have had to rely on leaked texts, while select corporate stakeholders, particularly in the US, like Monsanto most probably, not only have confidential access, but are also playing an active role in creating the proposed text of the agreement. This reminds me almost entirely of Obamacare, written almost completely by the insurance companies. The corporations write their own legislation to benefit themselves. I mean, isn't this what human beings do? They negotiate on their own behalf? And so what this corporate agreement is just basically, well, we'll allow the corporations to negotiate on their own behalf, but and write the legislation. But everybody else, you can just wait until 4 years after it's already been signed and implemented, bro. Just go away. You know, stop disagreeing with us. You know, you don't even know what's in it. What is there to disagree about? Oh my God, the cynicism of these people. I really do like this response from the Internet Party, though. That's good. The TPPA has become a tool for a country's corporate interests to negotiate with foreign governments. While free trade agreements were primarily government-to-government negotiations with balanced commercial and public policy interests, the TPPA represents narrow corporate profit maximization objectives, taking on quote-unquote partner governments by constraining their future domestic lawmaking abilities. Now, is a corporation a government? Would you like your government to be a corporation? And the answer, strangely enough, is actually yes. Your government is a corporation. So these are corporations negotiating with corporations that are masquerading as governments, who are writing corporate legislation as though with the same kind of backing as a government writing the legislation. This is the New World Order. That's how they do it, bro. Okay, if you've got economic independence, you can stick to yourself. You don't have to necessarily rely on other people. Nobody can really force you into compromising positions that you don't want to be part of. The founding fathers of the United States warned. They warned people about the consequences of entangled alliances. Because if your allies start doing something that you don't like, and if you're in a big partnership, alliance or something with them, you can't just walk away and go, nah, we don't want a piece of that pie, bro. You can't do that. Now we're all going to be bound. I don't understand, and I don't even like to use the word I don't understand, because I do understand. Not in the legalese sense of the word, meaning I stand under the power of these agreements, but I comprehend what they truly mean. I comprehend precisely the goals that are looking to be obtained here. A global, corporate, fascist government. Can we spell it out any clearer? No, we cannot. It's just that simple. If you want fascism on a global frickin' level, sign a partnership agreement with corporations. You know, it's a pretty easy step. Just go ahead, bro. You know, sign it up over the weekend or something. You can sit around, have a few glasses of incredibly expensive 700-year-old wine or something, you know, with dancing girls and children that you've had smuggled in from DynCorp, so you can celebrate after signing this piece of paper which enslaves everybody for the rest of time. It'd be great, mate. It'd be fun, wouldn't it? You know, be like a day at the races. You can get a new hat! Gosh! The illusion has been cast over everybody. What logical part? I'm sorry, I'm getting really angry about this, but my country's at stake. Your country's at stake. We should be getting upset about this. We should be emotionally involved, I think. Because these people are going to freaking destroy all that we hold dear in quick succession if we let them put this stuff through. And I feel guilty because there was a protest against this Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement in Hamilton a little while ago, and I didn't go. I was supposed to be leading it. And I was like freaked out about my computer and everything. I was like stressing. It was like the most stress I've ever been through in like a decade. And I couldn't go out and do it. And then I kind of forgive myself and go, well, guess what happens at a protest? They get ignored. Without fail. Every single gosh dang time. Sick of going out to protest about things that matter. And sitting there for about an hour and a half or something at the end of the protest, listening and recording these speakers, and then spending 24 hours, you know, working my butt off trying to edit it together so it's got two nice camera angles and well done sound and individual videos for each of the speakers so they can share them around their own little party candidates without having to listen to everybody else, as well as a full version for the entirety of the speeches. And when I don't see that get 10,000 or 100,000 views, it doesn't seem to me like a waste of effort. You know, it doesn't. It's just a shame, really, that people don't care enough about these activists. That people are in the dark so much that they have no idea what is going on around them. What is being said at these gatherings. How much extraordinary research these activists, commentators, journalists, and researchers have done that can literally help us out of our ignorance so that we will be able to see in the dark when the knives come at us. This is an important gig for me. It is more important than anything else in the world because the world is at stake. Not just the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement, but everything. There's scumbaggery all over the place, and it all has the same freaking agenda. Less freedom and money for everybody, except a little quantitative bunch of scum in the elite, who haven't had to work a day in their life since they were born into a $1 trillion banking family trust. You know, you ever tried to help somebody and they think that you can't help them, but the reality is you've actually got a lot of experience and you know exactly what they're going through and exactly how to help, but they don't believe it because nobody's ever helped them before. Nobody's ever listened. And you actually have to sit there and try and convince them that you're not trying to set them up. Go through that process. I implore you. It's a valuable process because then you get to see what a life is like when you spend your life of self-sacrifice for other people's freedoms. It is very hard, but you retain your soul. That is the thing that I've noticed about these people. They still have their soul. When I go to the political candidates' meetings and I see a lot of the other party heads come up and these talking muff rags of terrible chamois cloth bacterial growth getting up on the mic, spitting their lies, hoiking up their nonsense. It makes me sick. Sick to my stomach. To see them just sit there and blatantly lie, blatantly omit, blatantly cover up all the bad things that are going on and calling everybody, without exception, who exposes anything real, a conspiracy theorist or a nutter. Or tell people to ignore them. That really gets my goat. Maybe even my sheep too. Scumbags. Speaking of scumbags, John Key is in a little bit of trouble. I love this. He's coming back to New Zealand, right? He's cutting a trip short in Tokyo. Because he's really, really keen, apparently, to come back and help their little crew win the Northland by-election. Here's an article out of Radio New Zealand's news. Key acknowledges national trailing. Prime Minister John Key has conceded the National Party is in trouble in the Northland by-election and could struggle to hold the seat. At the start of the month, Prime Minister John Key said Winston Peters had zero chance of winning Northland.
Well, I guess that was a quick turnaround.
So he's coming back from Tokyo, right, just in order to make up all of this stuff. And the polls are all crazy, right? Like, Winston Peters got like 54% popular support. and the National candidate's got like 34%. The Labour candidate, you know, the next one down the chain's like 10% support. Winston's going to win. He put the win in Winston. That's what I'm talking about. Now, I don't know how many people know who Winston Peters is, okay? But let me just give you a background. 30-plus years experience in Parliament, been kicked out of a number of parties, has changed parties, has started a new party and all of this kind of stuff. You know what that says to me? Somebody who stands on principle. Somebody who stands on principle gets kicked out of organisations that don't stand on principle. It's just that simple. Anybody who's made a stand in the public light or against a massive organization that you're a part of will know precisely what I'm talking about. Now, the difficulty here is that the Prime Minister, and this is a great meme that came out from the Young Nats, the Young National Party members, I spell Nats with a G, saying that Winston basically is a bit corrupt or whatever because he's done all this shifting around in parties and created his own party and got out and everything. He's still in freaking Parliament, and anybody who's ever heard him speak gets convinced otherwise of the media portrayal about him, right? The media, when I had Andrew Williams, there we go, former North Shore mayor, I interviewed him at an electioneering event for a good 15 minutes, and we got into the dirt, mate. We got really into the dirt of how corrupt the media is, in particular against Winston Peters and New Zealand First. Myself and Penny Bright several years earlier went down to the archives of Auckland Library and poured over 6 months of election coverage in the New Zealand Herald newspaper. Now, when you're reading a newspaper every day and you see one article or whatever dissing Winston, after a while you start to get the idea that Winston's a bit of a scumbag. But if you go to the archives and you pour over 6 months in a couple of hours and you see article after article after article after editorial after editorial after editorial with no evidence of any kind the whole time from start to finish, and then him getting completely exonerated at the end of that article reading, you know, you just think to yourself, how can people not know this? And it's because the corrupt media are the people who would let you know, and they don't because they're corrupt. Ah, gosh. I really, really hope that Winston wins this election. I really hope he helps the people in Northland. I've got family up there. I know how bad the roads are in some places. I know how poor the economic output is in a lot of the areas out there. This is a region that has been neglected. Really. It just seems like full-on textbook Agenda 21 to me. Hey, here's this place. Oh, it's got resources. But it's also got people on top of those resources. How can we slowly, slowly destroy them so that they'll move out because there's no reason to stay? Oh, we'll freaking neglect them for ages. Bro, what, did you come up with that idea all by yourself? Well, yes, I did. What? That's great. That's great. Now, speaking of Winston, New Zealand First will introduce a bill in Parliament to remove name suppression from paedophiles where the victim or victims have not requested it or are asking for it to be removed. Leader and candidate of the Northland by-election, the Right Honourable Winston Peters, announced in Pai here today. There have been so many cases of sexual violence in New Zealand where the offender hides behind a cloak of secrecy imposed on the basis that secrecy protects the victim. And guess who might have been involved in one of these cases? You guessed it, the former Member of Parliament for Northland, Mike Sabin, who resigned for personal reasons. I could see this bit turning out great fun. We'll be right back, ladies and gentlemen, at the VinnieEastwoodShow.com. I'm really enjoying today's show. I really don't know why. We'll be right back. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. It's now the final segment of the Vinnie Eastwood Show. I have, like, enjoyed today's show so much, and I thank everybody for listening in from the bottom of my heart. I'm glad that I still have one. And something I was thinking about over the break, actually, is that the difference between a douchebag with a microphone like me and a douchebag with a microphone like the mainstream media is I have a heart, and they don't. That much is certain. Whether or not they have a brain, and I do, that still remains to be seen. Reading on from the Winston Peters announcement for the removal of name suppression in the cases of pedophiles and sexual abuse, he says, in cases where the victim wants exposure of the crime and not secrecy, the sub judice rules and name suppression and the legal cone of silence will be removed. In addition to this measure, we will also introduce a sex offender register so parents and families can know if one of these offenders is in their community or in their neighbourhood. I stand on the side of the victim, not the criminal. What a novel approach from a parliamentarian. Man, if I turned into like a Winston Peters cheerleader all of a sudden. I guess I kind of have been. Ever since he mentioned the commission management model for local government, I've kind of been on his side. Primarily because he said that the reason why commission management, let's define what that is. Okay, first of all, you've got public or private. All right? Public, everything's done in-house. Taxpayers pay for it. End of. Private is the taxpayers pay the private corporation to do it, end of. Now, what he said is commission management. You should get a group of professional managers to manage the account, get the jobs done, and if they improve the account and its holdings and reduce its debt or whatever kind of objectives you need to give them, they then get a bonus at the end of the year. So give them that impetus to do it. And you know what gave them the inspiration for that? Talking about the wealthiest families in the world and how they run all their wealth. Think about the DuPont family and the Rothschilds and all that. Who runs all this wealth? Not them. They have commissioned managers running it. As soon as I heard that, I was like, he sort of knows what's up, bro. However, if you're in an era of officialdom, you need to shy away from ways of getting demonized, particularly when you are, in my considered opinion, the New Zealand media's number one political target. If Winston steps out of line anywhere, anytime, in any way, they jump on him like a bunch of pack animals. Every time. That's why I support him for a large part as well. Because he's doing something right. Otherwise, they wouldn't be all over him like a pack of rabid fleas. Parasites. Speaking of parasites, swinging back to John Key, lies since the 2014 election. Yeah, here we are out of thestandard.org.nz. He's been a busy lad, that John Key, lying pretty much non-stop during the 2014 election campaign with his left-wing conspiracy mantra. Oh my God. Anybody else so effing tired of being called a conspiracy theorist for having facts that are inconvenient, that these scum won't believe, and if they do believe it, it's because they're in on it, and they call you a conspiracy theorist to discredit you so that other people won't listen to your facts? Anybody else sick of that? Anybody else? God! I'm sorry, I'm getting really upset. Just happens all the time, not just to me, but to people who have sacrificed a hell of a lot to expose scumbaggery. But anyway, on from that mantra, he's slowed down a bit since polling day on 20th September, settling onto a more sedate but steady pace, stretching from the very serious to the utterly ridiculous. His recent lies cover a wide selection of topics ranging from the independent Republic of Northland to the urgent need for new terrorism laws. The new prime ministerial cascade of mendacity was made all the more apparent by the orchestrated attempt of some of his senior ministers late last year to foster the meme that John Key was the most transparent Prime Minister New Zealand has ever had.
Oh my God!
Oh wait, he was serious. Sure, he's transparent, all right, but not in the way they were suggesting. Their tactic was a direct copy of the meme injection by Barack Obama's crew. But, surprise, surprise, it didn't really take hold here. Part of the problem was how every time the phrase was used, say half a dozen times, John Key told another lie. The lies which filled off the scheme and meme quickest were those concerning his on-again, off-again bromance with Cameron Slater. Those of you who are unaware, Cameron Slater is basically like a real dodgy blogger dude. Who's like dad was like president of the National Party or something like that, and the Prime Minister and him have been cooking together in their nice little meet and greets and what have you. Politicians know a lot of stuff, a lot of dirt on people, but they can't release it because it'll make them look bad. So what they do is they release it anyway, but they do it through a third party who has no conscience or soul, like Cameron Slater. Not to be, you know, too jutting about it. But let's skip to some of the lies. I'm sure we're going to run out of time long before I keep reading them out. Lie number one. The New Zealand military personnel are just attending a regular, ordinary meeting in the United States. He said that 13 times. No. Number two. New Zealand is not involved in any coalition to fight in the Middle East. Mm-mm. Yes, we are. Number three, it is not currently illegal for someone to fight overseas for a terrorist group. Yes, it is. Murder's still illegal. Doesn't matter whether you're fighting under the umbrella of, I'm a freedom fighter, that's why I kill children kind of banner. It just doesn't work, bro. It's illegal to kill people, just in general. Unless, of course, they're attacking you and killing you like the United States invading Iraq. Mm. Isn't that ironic? When it comes to requests for official information, my ministers always act within the law. No, they freaking don't. The amount of times me and Penny Bright have been on the phone together, laughing our asses off at the asinine responses we're getting out of responses from the Ombudsman and the Official Information Act and Minister Prime Keys. Prime Key. Yes, Prime Key. It's the last of the primes. Lie number five. I have never, never called or texted Cameron Slater in my capacity as Prime Minister. We know how that turned out. Number six. No, I did not mislead the House. On which day did he say that, whopper? I did not admit to having abused the Official Information Act process. Is that right? And number eight, another one. I did not mislead the House. It's just like this list of stuff that doesn't even have any information on it to expand to, because I think it's like the Skeptic Society, I know this will be an ironic quote from me, came up with this brilliant quote that is absolutely true, except they use it in the direct opposite context to which it should be used. The amount of work that it takes to refute BS... it's magnitudes larger than the amount of work it takes to come up with that BS. Like, I could just say, I'm 6 foot five when I'm 6 foot four, for example. Takes a second to make that lie, but in order for somebody to prove that I'm lying, they'd actually have to grab a measuring tape and then get me to stand there, and then if I was a lying scumbag, I probably wouldn't want them to measure me, would I? Because I'm trying to keep it secret. So you got to somehow tie me down, and in which case, when you tie me down, it'll probably do you to a chair or something, in which case I won't be extended out properly, so it'll be impossible to make the correct measurement. That's what they're talking about. BS is real difficult to prove that it's BS. It's unbelievable. The Gwynne report into the handling of the Official Information Act request by the SIS completely exonerated me. I don't even know what that is. How many lies has this guy told? It's daily. I can't believe that. I can't believe they only came up with 38. You know? It's just a constant process. And this is why I don't watch the news anymore. Because I'm angry. Sorry. Oh, I think it's actually Stephen Hughes that said this the best. I don't watch TV because of two reasons. I'm intelligent and I have a temper. All right, so when you're sitting there and you're watching the BS flow forth like some kind of polluted river from the gaping maw of these succubus son of a black sand beach. That's a really good pun there. Damn, I'm so awesome. Anyway, when you see that, coming out, and you don't see the journalists in the crowd challenging them on it and standing up and just going, hey, that's actually BS, sir. You said this, that, and the other, and blah, blah, blah. And even when they do that, when they do their duty as the Fourth Estate entitles them to do, you know, ask questions of the powerful people, keep watch on the powerful people, because they're the ones who can actually do a shockingly large amount of damage to the entirety of society when you're not looking. Dude snatches a bag, couple of years in prison. Dude snatches $1 billion, just let him go, son. He's got enough money to leak into the economy. It'll pay off. Unbelievable. Ladies and gentlemen, you need to stop trusting authority. Stop trusting authority. Certain authority is justified, but stop blindly trusting it, for goodness sake, because they will use your trust against you. Everything that is good about you will be used against you by those who have nothing good about them at all. Like the Prime Minister, like the President, Barack H. O'Barry, and like any number of other head honcho scumbaggery leaders that we know and love and enjoy, don't we? They're all the freaking same kettle of fish, and they need to be dumped back in the water and allowed to grow up. We'll see you again sometime, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you very much for listening to the VinnieEastwoodShow.com. And we'll see you again sometime, assuredly.